Good evening, friends. This is your host on Valley Writers Read, Franz Weinschenk, delighted to welcome you to another program featuring the stories of local writers. Tonight, a story entitled Elegy by R.D. Sibley.
Elegy. Quickly and precisely, he took things from the dead man. He had to hurry. He was aware of the wet jungle around him, but he could not hear anything. Now and again, he would look up and scan the surrounding forest. He was afraid that more shells would fall. He did not know how close the enemy might be. He cut the rucksack straps from his friend's shoulders and put away his knife. He took his own rucksack off his sweat-sticky back, and as he collected things from his partner's ruck and pockets, he stuffed them inside. He wanted to just take his friend and go, but he couldn't, and he needed these things. There was more light than usual in the jungle. It was coming from the small open area where he had been moments before, the same clearing where his friend Albert Contreras Rivas had been killed. Minutes ago, he was walking ahead and Al was following. Before the artillery rounds had impacted, he thought he felt a change in the air, almost like a sound, but not like a sound. There was no whistling like in the movies. There was just this almost imperceptible change to the air, like before an electrical storm, the air charged and an ozone smell. It was not exactly like that, but the feeling was like that. The small hairs on his neck had prickled. Then there was the completely expected but impossible to believe loud crump, and he was knocked into the air amid confusion, dirt, and debris. Several rounds landed all together, and he was spun around and bounced off the jungle floor as the earth bucked beneath him like a trail horse. It went on forever. It lasted a few seconds. The movies didn't come close. He had picked up his rifle and started running. But then he remembered that Al was behind, and he ran back to the cloud of filthy fog, dirt, and smoke, and the stink of high explosive, and he couldn't hear anything. And then there at the edge of the clearing was Albert, lying still and face down, his hat and the sniper rifle gone. He had grabbed Albert's ruck straps and, with adrenaline strength, dragged him into the jungle to where he now lay. Dead. Still hearing nothing of the world outside of himself, the remaining scout sniper unholstered his partner's pistol and threw it into the jungle. He took Al's map and shoved it into one of his own pockets. Same with his logbook. The claymore, anti-personnel mine, the bandolier, all components of the mine in a convenient, for killing, sling pouch. And last of all, he freed the radio from the big commo pocket just inside the top of Al's ruck. He went to remove the handset from the left suspender of Al's combat harness and saw that half of it was gone. Fine. Colorful wires were sprouting from jagged black plastic. He had a spare handset already in his own ruck. He stopped for a moment then. He looked at Albert's young face. He really didn't want to, but he did. Al seemed to be alive and startled, but the new bright red blood under his nose and mouth were out of place in a horrible contrast to his green camouflage face paint. The open eyes, trying to see, to stay here, right up to the last. They were swollen and shiny red where they should have been white. The mustaches Al cared for with so much Mexican pride were bloodstained, dirty. A thin wisp of smoke curled up from somewhere inside his shirt, some persistently burning material inside. He felt very bad that he could not stay with Al. The abrupt treatment felt wrong. He felt like he was robbing his dead friend of his equipment, or worse, he was taking things from his friend because Al could no longer bear his portion of the load. And that was worse, like he was doubting Al's strength or his commitment. He cried then. Instantly, without shame or sound, the tears were there, and they blended with the sweat dripping down his face. His stomach was churning acid, and the fear and adrenaline were making him nauseous. His hands began to shake as they finished their tasks. Shouldering his now heavier pack, he picked up the team's smaller M16 service rifle, which it had been his turn to carry when the rounds fell. He retracted the bolt, observed a glittering brass round in the chamber, returned the bolt forward, closed the dust cover, and left the place where he had lost his best friend. He moved as steadily and as quietly as he could at his fastest walking pace, which was very fast by infantry terms. His long, slim legs were all bone and muscle from the familiar exercise of walking with rifle, ruck, and equipment. He was easily carrying over a third of his body weight and would be able to do so for many clicks or kilometers without difficulty. He reached absently into the cargo pocket on the right thigh of his trousers and took out a spare soft cap and put it on his head. His floppy boonie hat had been lost in the earth-buckling tossing. He didn't leave any too obvious sign of his passing, though at this pace he knew it was impossible to leave no sign at all. He ducked his head or bent and twisted his 6-foot body as he moved, avoiding the branches and vines. The muzzle of his rifle was always first to pass through the space between the plants where his body would follow, and so his movement was always steady, flowing, and nothing came between him and his rifle. Moving through woods had been something he'd been good at, even as a boy, and if an observer saw that it was unusual and shapeless and unforced, how he smoothly glided through and around the forest, the soldier did not think of it at all. His black, nylon and leather jungle boots stepped among the bushes and plants and onto the soft, rotting floor of the jungle. The trees in 3 layers above him cast their green light in the lush forest. His hearing was slowly coming back. He needed to hear very badly, wanted to be able to hear so bad that it was impossible he'd ever wanted anything else so much. Every 20 meters or so, he would turn and look back upon his trail on both flanks, and then continue walking northwest, away from the scene of Albert's murder. He had learned a few months ago that it was murder, not a war at all, not even a war his family knew he was fighting, just very personal murder. You can forget politicians, nations, or foreign policy. He and Albert had committed murder in their time there. It was their job, and they had become very good at it. Sniping is not like a regular infantryman's killing. Sniping is shooting someone and seeing their face in the scope. They may be changing their socks, they may be eating lunch, writing a letter home, or going to the bathroom. That's the strength of sniping. It is the psychologically devastating long-range killing of key select targets. It is a 173-grain, copper-jacketed kinetic psyop. Officers, radio men, and sergeants first. A unit that has been attacked by a sniper will never feel safe again, anywhere, anytime. But now Al had been the one killed. The remaining sniper was becoming able to think now, and it was a very focused effort. He was starting to feel very angry. He had stopped crying some time ago, without shame or sound, and he was trying to figure out what he should do. He did this thinking while other deeper, older parts of his brain, unchanging instinct, took information in from his eyes, nose, and even his numb ears and other less easy-to-explain senses, and processed that into threat or acceptable categories. This information would not pass through his conscious mind, but instead send signals straight to his arms, legs, hands, as needed. He stopped walking. He did not stop abruptly, rather, he continued into a crouch with the footfall that he was naturally on, and his head and body pivoted to the right as he brought his rifle smoothly up to point toward some rustling noise and movement, and his right thumb rode the selector switch of the rifle all the way from safe, past semi, and onto burst. Not flipping the small lever and thereby making a metallic click, but maintaining a smooth, steady pressure to get it there, index finger lightly on the trigger. He'd been in combat long enough to do things this way, but not so long that he was jittery and exhausted and no good. That would come eventually. But now he was good and did the right things. The jungle's thick vegetation and close engagement range precludes the formality of closing one eye and lining up front sight post with rear sight ring. His jungle warfare school teachers call it instinct shooting, and it is true. He had his rifle to his shoulder now, but simply looked over the sights with both eyes open. There was no follow-on sound or indicator of a threat. It was probably a small animal startled by his passing. He's glad his hearing is coming back, but thinks he'll likely hear a lot of otherwise normal forest sounds and react similarly. He rose slowly, then crouched back down and threw up very quietly. Some water and bile came up. Nothing else. He did not think it was so strange. He had thrown up before from time to time, in training, while running in formation, or when the heat became too much, or he had forced too much water into his stomach. He threw up. After checking his back trail and flanks, he again started off walking, wiping the spit and bile off his lips with the back of his left hand. He never took the right hand off the rifle if he had a choice. Everything was done with the hand controlling the bullets in its place on the rifle's pistol grip. And this was routine, too, like moving through the forest, and he thought nothing of it. Now he changed his line of march to due north. He recalled what his map of the area would show, and he knew he needed to go to the north for about 3 more clicks, which should take about an hour. He would terrain count down his way to the place where he would execute his just-created plan. First, he would expect to go downhill for several hundred meters, then cross a saddle, then a seasonal jungle stream, gradually rising ground for about a click, and then level ground, paralleling a cliff to the east, on his right, a cliff he would never see through the trees, but it would be there nonetheless. This way, he could expect what to encounter on the way and not have to keep referring to his map. He continued walking, the sweat dripping steadily now, and with his left hand he let go of his rifle's forestock and removed his lensatic compass from the top left pocket of his blouse. Opening it with the same hand, he glanced to see that he was indeed walking due north. He replaced it in his pocket and took the canteen from the left side of his combat harness and drank the entire quart. The water was bitter and acrid from the iodine purification tablets. It tasted good, of course, since he knew what it was like to have no water at all. He dabbed at the sweat around his blue-gray eyes with the fingertips poking out of his leather half-glove. Then he put his hand back on the black plastic forestock and pressed onward. The sweat was a salty sting to the eyes, and especially when it was mixed with the rough green camo makeup now on his face and head. His thoughts resumed their course. He was thinking over his tactical situation and what he would do in the next few hours. He told himself he had to stay focused and not be too afraid, though that was not his to control. He reminded himself that being afraid isn't always bad. It can make one very careful, and careful is very good. He thought about Al's mother now, and how her heart would be twice broken if the body of her son were not returned to her for a proper Catholic burial. The walking soldier wondered how elaborate a Mexican Catholic funeral mass must be. He remembered the face of Albert's mother from the time he had visited her home in Visalia, California. The tortillas, they had tasted so good, baked fresh, piled high in the warm kitchen, and he recalled how he and Al had eaten so much that they couldn't move, but lay in chairs on the tilting porch as the sun dropped down over the fields with their long rows of lettuce and the long water pipes and poles putting water out over them, Tecate beer cans, salt, limes, and cigarettes as the sun had set. How it had pleased Senora Contreras that they had eaten so much, just like his mother would have been. She kept going close to Al during that visit for any reason at all, bringing a cold beer or emptying the ashes, and she would touch him in small ways, smile and rub her hands on her apron. She didn't speak much English, but Al, of course, spoke his family's Guadalajara Spanish, and the other soldier's own Spanish wasn't too bad. The soldier was sure that the nature of he and Al's work here would not allow for Al's body to be reclaimed. The United States did not have troops fighting in the jungle of this small nation, so they said. Some advisors, yes, but no combat troops. That was the line. He had to get Al's body, or he didn't think anyone ever would. His hearing was pretty good now, and the walking had helped to relieve the tension which always followed the adrenaline. He again thought through the plan that was now in his mind. As the invisible sun continued its afternoon track, it grew ever darker in the jungle, and he passed through the saddle, high ground on his left and right. The stream would be his next terrain marker. Back at the place of recent death, someone else now went through Al's open pockets and rucksack, while this searcher's three companions formed a small perimeter around them. The man doing the searching was Lieutenant Juan Saldez Marquerdo. It was he that had selected the killing place for observation and previous artillery fire registration, thus the accuracy of the first salvo. He had a good mother, but he did not know the name of his father, and this tortured him. The Saldez Marquerdo of his name was just the same as his mother's father. In the failing light, he could find nothing of intelligence value on the dead man. He was Latino, probably Mexican. That was obvious. He also assumed that he was an American, but could find no proof. He hadn't really expected to find any. No American soldier doing the criminal work that this one had done would have his dog tags or ID card conveniently on him. No U.S. Army sewn above the right pocket. But he knew that the American people had sent special soldiers to help the federal army of this small nation in their fight against the rebels. All of this American's clothing and load-bearing equipment were in good working order, or at least they had been, before the new mortars at the rebel base camp dropped rounds on the pair of snipers as they were seen emerging from the jungle. The uniformity of this dead man's equipment said America, and the quality of it and the way it had obviously been cared for troubled Saldez. He could not get his own soldiers to take so much care with their equipment, not even when they had gotten new belts and ammo pouches from the government of a neighboring country, sympathetic to their cause. Even more tellingly American than the equipment was the condition of the dead man's teeth. They were all there, and in good condition. No cavities. Some had fillings. To check one last thing, he removed the dead man's camouflage blouse. He pushed up the brown undershirt's left sleeve, and there on the man's upper arm was a small circular scar from a smallpox vaccination, such as the U.S. Army gives to all their soldiers when they're first enlisted. He checked the other arm, too, but there were no tattoos. He was sure that this was an American soldier. This sniper team he had halfway killed was probably the same one that had been killing his soldiers in this area for the last 3 months. He had lost 7 good soldiers to these 2 snipers. and two not-so-good soldiers. Now he had wounded this team, cut it in half. He had killed one of the killers. He wanted to kill the other one, too. With a little bit of luck, he'd be able to. Luck and speed, he thought to himself. It was fast growing dark, and the other Yankee, a gringo, whether he too was Latino or not, had a head start. It would be better to catch up to him before it was fully dark. Lieutenant Saldez's eyes hurt from another headache. He did not know why he got so many headaches now. Before the revolution had started, he had been a foreman at the banana plantation in Modelo and never got headaches. This headache now was a very bad one. He took some of the precious aspirin he had from his mother and drank some water, and then he straightened the legs of the dead man and crossed his arms upon the chest. He took a clean undershirt from the man's rucksack and carefully folded it into a square and gently rested it upon the face. Saldez had found a rosary in the top flap of his enemy's ruck, and he laid this upon the dead hands. Then, still on his knees next to the enemy, he took out his own rosary, lowered his head, and said a prayer for the soul of Albert Contreras Rivas. As an afterthought, he prayed that God might help him to also kill the dead man's partner, thus reuniting the sniper team in the afterlife. Amen. After this, he studied his map for a moment and found the nearest place that he knew a helicopter could land. It was not very far away, about 3 kilometers. He carefully put away his map and, picking up his rifle, walked into the forest, signaling his men to follow him. The American was now close to the place where he had chosen to do something unexpected. He knew that there were men following him, the same men that had called down the artillery. These men could probably guess where he was going, and they would think that he would call a helicopter to take him away. Half a sniper team was not much good, and why wouldn't he want to go away? But they didn't know about homemade tortillas, the green fields and rich-smelling dirt, the setting sun seen from a crooked porch. They did not know about his own mother, Al's mother, in aprons, and the feeling of a worn but soft hand on one's neck during a visit home. And so they did not know what he would do for these things. It was only 2 years ago. He had left his own home the day before, and now it was dusk of the following day as he turned the car onto the dirt road, the crossroad, as it was called by the locals. It was late September and fine Indian summer weather in Maine. The old men that held no great council in the town's general store would say the day was finest kind. It was fine. The young man thought it was fine to be 18 years old and graduated from high school. The car went up the dusty road under a following strip of blue sky. The trees and bushes in the road ditches, heavy with a full summer of new growth, were leaning over. The young man was thinking of California. He had enlisted in the Army that day, and he was going to go to California. Before that, he would go to Georgia for 3 months of infantry school. He had never been to the Confederate States before. His grandfather had gone before to Fort Benning in between the World Wars, and his great-great-grandfather had gone to the South before that with the 42nd Massachusetts Volunteers to fight a war of his own. But this boy had never been anywhere but home, in New England. He wondered what the trees were like in those other places in the fall. He wondered if the autumn air had a strong smell of bird hunting and the start of school, and if the spring air smelled of snow melt, mud, and baseball. He drove down the middle of the narrow, empty road with both windows rolled down for the clean air to come in. He was anxious about the new life he had started that day, but he did not question whether or not he had done the right thing. His other options seemed so dismal. The thought of going to a trade school or university turned his stomach. More years of endless classes. He could find some job, but felt it would kill him if he didn't get out of this beautiful place where nothing ever happened. He had to go. He had felt like he had been waiting to be a soldier for a long time. He doesn't know why. The smooth dirt track wound on, gently rising and then falling, and he followed it, past the place where Good Brook went underneath it in two big steel culverts. The trees marched out into the wilderness to his left and right, poplar, spruce, cedar, pine, and others, the firs evergreen and the others gold, yellow, startling red and orange. The beauty of New England woods in autumn is not exaggerated. The big fat ferns tilted towards him from the ditches, and some of the bolder ones brushed the car as he drove past. A ways up the road, two grouse went running across the dirt and dappled sunlight in their fleet but funny-looking way. He did not mark the spot, though, as he wasn't near the places where he went bird hunting. He made the sharp left turn at the Warrens' camp. The Warren family was not there, but he was sure they would be up from their boat business on Rangeley Lake for the coming deer season. The woods stepped back from the road now, and the pretty, high, high blue spread out without a cloud. The shadows of the trees were leaning to the east. It was going to be another pretty sunset later, seen from the front windows of the house after supper. It was just Mom, Dad, and him then. His older brothers and sisters had already gone. It was pretty quiet in the house, and in a few weeks, when he left, His parents will have ended their 36 years of raising children. He didn't think of that in any special way, just that 36 years was twice his age, and it seemed impossible that anything could go on for that long. Through the turn now, and slowing down a bit where the road splits, the right fork going on to pass the Worcester house and then a mile or so more as it loops back to the paved road, he veers to the left instead, and soon the field he has grown up in is on his right, a big field, though it will grow smaller as he grows older. Many years ago it was first cleared to plant potatoes, but now it's all grown grass, clover, and wild strawberries. Off in the far corner is a little brown house with a gambrel roof and white smoke coming from the chimney. It has dark brown pine boards nailed standing side by side on its walls, and big, thick, rough-cut cedar shingles on the roof that he helped split in the backyard when he was 9 or so. The westering sun shone brightly orange on the front windows and the trees around the edge of the field. It looked comfortable, but lonesome. Not many cars pass by, and each is quickly noted through the window by Mom's corner seat at the big kitchen table. He was sure she'd be putting on the kettle for his coffee then and getting out a plate of supper that she'd kept warm in the oven. He wondered if she was still scared, because she'd looked a little scared when he left the day before, but he could tell she was trying not to let it show. He turned into the long driveway and parked next to the truck, and his big black mutt was jumping around all happy. He got out with his bag and gave the dog a big scratch and ruffled up his fur, and then they both went in the back door. Mom and Dad were at the kitchen table right there, and he set his bag down and said he had joined and would be leaving in a few weeks. Dad was quiet with his head down a bit, and Mom asked him what job he had signed up for, and he had said the infantry. And that made her face twist up. She asked why he'd done that. She was crying a little bit. He had never made his mom cry before, and he knew it wasn't something he should be doing, making her cry like that. 2 years and half a world later, the jungle was thinning now, and the soldier squatted down. He had come to the place he had chosen, a deep saddle, wide and nearly flat in the middle. It was almost 200 meters across and 50 meters wide. He and Al had first seen it about a month ago. He wondered how it could be here in the forest, what had happened to make it. There was rock just under the bushes and grass, and that must be what held the jungle at bay. Along the edge, there were a few stunted trees. It was a good place to shoot people following behind. He could easily cross to the far side, find a good firing position, and wait for the men coming after him. But the men coming to kill him would not go into this open space, or even come very close to its edge. They were not just walking somewhere, they were hunting an armed man, and so would be more careful. The east side of the clearing, to his right, opened to a cold spring, and the rocky ground fell away steeply, and he could hear the water splashing down. That side provided no cover and no easy passage around the open area. Opposite the cliff, the ground rose slowly. On the other side of the open area, the vegetation thickened quickly into jungle, and when his pursuers arrived, they would go around on that side, because they had to. They would be here in about an hour or so. It would be dark 30 minutes after that. They would wait until it was dark to start around the open area. Then at first light, they would begin again to look for him. The moon was in the sky already, and he knew and saw that it was a half moon. Sometimes he hated the moonlight, but tonight he would need it. He had much to do now before he was ready. He walked straight across the wide saddle, flattening the tall grass as he went. Once in the jungle on the other side, he chose the first large tree as his cache point. He dropped his ruck and rifle. He didn't actually drop them, but that's the language that they used to say that they put something down or took something off. He took the things he would need from his rucksack. He put on his ghillie top, the modified blouse with camo netting, and green and brown burlap strips, shredded, to blend in with vegetation. He laid it down and chose grasses and bushes to add to it. Then he took off his combat harness, to leave that with his ruck and rifle, and he put the ghillie top on over his blouse. He took out and camouflaged his ghillie hat, too. Tucking the veil inside the hat, he put it on his head. He put his knife on his trousers belt and put his pistol and a spare magazine in his pants cargo pocket. He wolfed down some unfinished rations and drank some more water. He set his ruck and his rifle against the base of the tree and covered them with vegetation. Then he rose and started walking around the clearing on the passable side. He was looking for a place, and he would know it when he saw it. He had always known these sorts of things. He had a sense of place and instinct about how things might happen in a certain way, in a certain place, like when he was bird hunting as a boy, or deer hunting. He could tell a place where he had better be ready because it felt like the right kind of place for deer or birds to be, and it almost always was. Near the midpoint of his passage around the clearing, he found it, a short, straight, natural lane among the vegetation, with an animal trail running through it. The hunters would not use the trail, of course, but there was not enough room to pass between it and the clearing. They would stay just in the jungle, on the outer side of this trail. As they picked their way quietly along, He would be waiting, pistol in one hand and the firing device for his Claymore mine in the other. And when their point man was right in front of him, he would trigger the mine, which would be farther back a ways, 10 meters or so, taking out the next two or three. He was reasonably sure that in the dark they'd be close enough together, and then when the mine blew, he would shoot the point man in front of him. Then he would crawl carefully down the trail, making sure the rest were dead too. Then he would go pick up his gear and go back for his friend Albert. That day 2 years and a lifetime ago, he had eaten his dinner with the old folks at the big table. He told them that he had signed up for 3 years in the infantry, assignment to a post in California after basic training in infantry school. "Why so far away, honey?" his mother had asked. "Why the infantry? Why not something with computers? You're so smart, honey." "I don't know why, Ma. I just don't want to do those other things. I want to be a soldier. That other stuff is just like school. If I want to do something like that, I should go to vocational school like Rob did or college. I don't want to do that, Ma." His parents were quiet while he ate the potatoes, bread and butter, carrots and deer meat. Then he'd gotten up and left the table, rinsing and putting his dishes in the sink. Father said, looking at the table, "You'll be okay. You're a smart boy. Just don't do anything foolish. We're very proud of you." His mother did the best she could. "As long as you're happy, we just want you to be happy." "I'm happy, Ma." "Good night, Ma. I love you," he had said as he kissed her old soft cheek. "Good night, Dad. I love you." "Good night, boy," his father said. And the youngest son kissed him goodnight, just as he had for as long as he could remember. The boy went away to the other end of the small house to his room. And that night he lay awake a long time, staring at the wood beams of the ceiling. He couldn't figure any other way to do it. How could he tell his parents that he had to go away, that he couldn't stay, because if he didn't go away, he would just shrink up and die? The next worst thing to being who and what you are is being somewhere where everyone else knows who and what you are, too. If he stayed, he'd just be another Mainer like everyone else there in that beautiful backwoods place. He had to go, and this is something he thought he knew absolutely. And so he would not marry a local girl by age 22 and have 5 kids and never leave New England. He would not go to the university in the small town an hour away, or the vocational school to be a blue or white-collar man. And he wouldn't drive truck or work in the woods, nor the potato fields or at the paper mill, which stunk to high heaven. He absolutely would not do any of these things. They had all been done before. No, the only way was the army, and he was going to California. It was settled, and he really had no choice, and he was lucky to be leaving. And that was that. He went to sleep that night and dreamed of being a hero on the battlefield, and he dreamed of girls on the California beaches, and he dreamed the dreams of a young man. He slept well the whole night through. Then it was morning 2 years later, and he was back with Albert. He sat down next to him and leaned back to take the weight of his rucksack off his shoulders. He was tired. Albert was swollen. His pants and T-shirt seemed puffed up. His neck looked fat. The jungle was trying to take him before his friend could come back for him. Things had gone all right last night, he thought to himself and to Albert. He wished he could tell Al about how he felt after the artillery yesterday and about how he had come up with a plan to come back for him. But Al wouldn't hear, couldn't hear. He wanted to tell Al how he had waited for the enemy and shot one and blown the mine on the others, and he wanted to tell him that the first man had only been wounded by his pistol shot. And when he had gone back for his gear, that soldier had leapt up at him and tried to stab him, had stabbed him, while shouting what sounded like a name, though he could not quite decipher it afterward. He had struggled then with the dying man and broken from his grip and emptied the rest of the pistol into him while the moon shone down. And then it was his turn to bleed from several wounds. And he yet still bled, though less now. "Al, I came back for you, Al," he said out loud, and thought it strange that his voice barely worked, croaking whisper. He was very tired, thirsty too. He had meant to fill his canteens at the spring by the clearing before he'd left the place of his one-man ambush, but for some reason he had forgotten. His blood-sticky shirt stuck to him, and he wanted to change his undershirt and socks. He knew it was time to. He looked up at the sky through the green leaves as he leaned there on his rucksack, legs stretched out, and he felt like he could sleep for days. He thought he smelled something familiar then, like autumn or spring, tortillas, a mother's kitchen, or the woods of Maine or fields of California, something. But he closed his eyes and it was gone. He put one hand out to rest it on Al's swollen hands. The rosary the late Lieutenant Saldez had placed there slid off to the ground, but the sniper team did not notice.
That was R.D. Sibley reading his story, Elegy. If you're like me, you've probably read stories in the newspapers about snipers and special forces, and always kind of wondered what they do. Well, from the story we heard tonight, although it's fiction, we get some idea of what these soldiers' missions are. Thank you, R.D., for such a riveting narrative. And so we come to the close of another segment of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read program again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be C.B. Mosier. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.